Welcome to the Big Beatles Sort Out, a show in which I, author and musician Gary Abbott, attempt to finally decide my favourite Beatles recordings by scoring each and every one for lyrical content, musicality and production, assisted by my brother and resident Beatles expert, Paul Abbott. Each episode we explore and score five songs pulled at random from the Beatles' full recording catalogue. Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the Beatles. Welcome to episode 41, and welcome to A Bit of What Is Paul Around You, Abbott.
Oh, excellent. Hello, good evening, good morning.
Good evening and good morning.
Well, yeah, delete as appropriate. I always say good evening because it's evening now, but you know, there you go. Hello. Sorry.
It could be a morning somewhere where someone's listening to this at this point.
It probably is. More likely, yeah, isn't it? I don't know. Sorry, everyone.
It's okay. So don't forget, you can keep in touch with us at big_sort on Twitter and Instagram or by email to bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com. And do please drop us a review on whatever platform you're listening on if you can. And also like and share our posts and just shout the podcast name at people. From my point of view, you can find out various things about me and all my work on garyabbott.com and garyabbott.co.uk. That is my blog and my website, respectively. Paul, is there anything you would like to point out to people?
No, just all the usual stuff. You know, just come and find us on Twitter and say hello, join in the discussion, be nice, and then give us a really good rating.
Right, Paul, on this Beatles Day, 19th of July.
19th of July, 1967, I have suggested for this one. It's a meeting in London. So, you know, they had lots of meetings.
Yeah.
But they're down to getting together to discuss the plans for Magical Mystery Tour. And, more specifically, to buy an island in Greece.
I know a bit about this one.
So, yeah, this was genuinely something that they were all like, oh, yeah, okay. So we're just post Pepper here. Mm. Brian's still around, so at this point. So it's John sort of saying, we're all going to live there, perhaps forever.
Who's Heather?
Well, Heather McCartney later on. No, he didn't say that. He says, we're all going to live there, perhaps forever, just coming home for visits. Or it might just be 6 months a year. It'll be fantastic, all on our own on this island. There are some little houses which we'll do up and knock together and live communally. So John's got this big hippie idea.
Yeah.
That they're going to have like, and you know, Derek Taylor sort of expounds on this idea, they're going to have like a central compound and all, but sort of all the other people that are sort of inner circle would be there as well on sort of these outer bits of this central area, and they could just... I mean, essentially, as far as I can tell, the real reason is they just wanted to be able to smoke marijuana in peace.
Right.
And not have anyone tell them off.
Yeah.
And so a good idea, buy your own island.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's the most outlandish of the ideas you hear about. Wasn't Magic Alex involved in this in some way?
Yeah, well? John had met Magic Alex in 1966, I believe, and he sort of charges him. So this is pre-Apple Electronics, but he sort of charges him with going off to Greece and looking for islands and properties. And then a couple of weeks after this, they go off on this sort of jaunt all together, sort of to go island hopping, which was great for them for a while they were having a nice time on a boat in the sunshine, but not when it turns out that buying an island is quite difficult and the weather changes and all this sort of stuff. And they failed to take into account that as of April of 1967, a far-right military junta had taken over Greece.
Right, yeah.
So it wasn't like it was just a holiday destination.
No.
This is a difficult and complicated place. You know, this is a military junta backed by the US... you know, financially, because they were anti-communist, but it's still, they've got a history of doing that, the US government. Yeah. And then they have to buy special currency in order to buy stuff. So they find somewhere they want to buy. Apparently this island's called Aia Triada, near Eritrea on Evia. I don't really know much about Grecian geography, but that's it. So you can find a picture of this, you know, because it exists in the world. Look on Google Maps. So they buy a load of this special sort of trade dollars that they need to buy it, end up not buying it, but actually end up making a profit because the exchange system changed in their favour when they sold these dollars back to them.
Oh, okay.
So they've gone off, had this mad holiday, failed to buy an island, failed to do this thing. But it's about the most rock star-y thing to do. But of course, the weird thing with the Beatles is they never, despite the Rolls Royces and the money and all that sort of stuff, they never seem to have that we're doing it because we're rock stars. It was like, we're doing it because we need to spend the money, because we're hippies, because we've got these ideals. It's, you know, the big rock star excess thing comes later, sort of late 60s, 70s type thing. But this is just a strange, mad moment that comes out of this meeting on 19th of July, 1967. It's like, well, what are we doing next? And shall we buy an island?
Fair enough. We've all had our, let's all live in a community, commune type of thing. I'm sure we've all had friendship groups where at points in our lives we've gone, hey. I mean, I once looked around a mansion with a group of my friends in some kind of loose idea that we might all pitch in. Never happened, obviously.
Well, you know, and those, for anyone who's lived communally as a student in a student house, eventually the idea of sharing with people wears off. Much as you might love them.
It's hard to imagine if it would have only accelerated the end if they had have lived on an island.
Imagine all the Beatles and all their wives and, you know, also stuck on an island.
Having that, like, living kind of, I mean, it's one thing to be a band in the centre of a kind of attention and have your kind of entourage as part of your kind of work life. Imagine it gets a bit something else when you're inviting people to uproot their lives and kind of live with you guys as the centre of it, you know. It has a bit of an obnoxiousness about it in a way. Although I'm sure it would have been fun for a while if they'd have done it.
Yeah.
But great, that's a good one. They're always good, Paul. I said that in a way. Like,
oh, you're going to rate them as well, are you?
Yeah, well, that's the next series. We're just going to rate on the Beatles Day. No, we're not. So let's get on with the random picks. And first up, Hey Jude. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better. And anytime you feel the pain, hey Jude, refrain, don't carry the world upon your shoulders. Hey Jude, Paul.
Hey Jude, Paul. Is that hyphenated? Anyway, yes, Hey Jude is, again, this is one that could have come out as the last song, couldn't it? We got so close. You know, the big sing-along end thing. This could have come out as our final one.
But it's another one that would have been a fitting end if we had secretly chosen the order.
But it is Hey Jude. It is a single that was backed with Revolution. Came out on the 30th of August, 1968. Spent 16 weeks in the charts in the UK. Two of those at number one. Its current official home in the discography is on the Past Masters 2 record.
Okay.
And it's often referred to as their most successful single. It's not their biggest selling, but it's most successful, as in it spent the most weeks in the most places for the longest around the world, essentially.
Right.
And, yeah, so it starts off, they record it on the 29th and 30th of July, 68, in Abbey Road. But then they move to Trident Studios, whose name's going to pop up a couple of times this episode, on the 31st of July and the 1st and 2nd of August to totally remake it. And so the version we know is the one from Trident Studios. It is a song that is so easy to take for granted because of its well-knownness and its lifespan with McCartney, an association with McCartney. But goodness me, it's worthy of its legend.
It certainly is. And that's, it's definitely... perhaps the most played Beatles song, I would say, wouldn't it? Either, or the one that people would probably claim to have heard more than any of us, because we are so familiar with it, because he's taken it into his solo career, quite rightly, as a show opener. But when you sit and listen to a show opener, show closer, in fact.
Closer,
but when you sit and listen to it, it's undoubtedly an epic song. I mean, when you sit and play around on the piano, as you'll know, Paul, writing songs around C major shapes, kind of moving and up and down the kind of natural cadences and patterns that your fingers take you to, it can be incredibly hard not to end up sounding like you're trying to copy Hey Jude and Let It Be.
Let It Be's in C, Hey Jude's in F. But
well,
I know
yeah,
you
sorry.
Me.
I mean, when you're playing with major chords around, you know, the kind of natural major progressions you get, because what Paul did when he wrote those two songs especially, it's kind of almost perfectly define what a piano and melody-led rock ballad sounds like.
Yes.
He's captured it so well that, you know, it's almost a singularity from which none other can escape if you're trying to do something ish, because they're it, aren't they? And this is this one, like you say, it's about it being just such a good song. He's almost done it. You've almost kind of can tick it off. Well, that's kind of piano-led rock ballads done, then, isn't it? Mm. But so we might feel like we've all heard this a million times at the Olympics, at the Queen's birthday, at all his live concerts, at Glastonbury, at parties, at discos. Therefore, gained a reputation as maybe being a bit overplayed song, somewhat.
And it's a long song. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. You know, it's 7 minutes, 11 seconds long. I mean, the actual verses and choruses before the outro only take up 3 minutes and 10 seconds of that.
Yeah.
You know, that's another 4 minutes of outro, which
it's a strange thing to do, but they did.
Yeah,
it.
A new thing that sort of heralds in a new era of songs being long.
Yeah.
As singles rather than just album tracks.
And like its longevity in time and in history, it manages it because it's a hell of a good song.
It is. It's so simple. Yeah, but it's very just simple. Every element of it is simple.
And this is what I meant.
Even down to the orchestration, you know. But it's just put together perfectly.
It is. And this is what I meant about the plonking around on the piano. You can quite quickly end up falling over chords that will sound a bit like this without knowing what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
But you've got to be Paul McCartney to have done it so concisely with that simpleness that you get this. And from a musical point of view, with the exception of the amazing Ringo drums, which you know, the way he does those kind of almost offbeat shuffled rolls that he does, you know, the way he brings different sections in and out. Hey Jude has nothing particularly exemplary about the music, does it? Beyond the songwriting craft, there's no guitar solo.
There's no sort of pyrotechnics in any of the parts. I mean, even like the little bit of electric guitar that George plays on it is so subtle.
I didn't even know it was there, to be honest.
Partly because this is one of the flashpoints between him and McCartney.
Right.
Of him wanting to play, you know, as they're sort of putting this together, George is wanting to play these answering phrases as a guitarist is wont to do in response to the vocal lines. And McCartney's like, no, I don't want that. Play less. And obviously this is the thing that's sort of referred back to in the argument in the Get Back sessions. But they leave, you know, eventually there's some little tiny bits of George in there as well. But nothing much, you know, it's piano, strummed guitar.
Yeah,
and a bass. Some other bits. Kind of just... And even, like I say, even the orchestration is big block chords. Yeah. It's when the orchestra comes in at the end. So.
Yeah, they're pretty much just like just doing the root note and just starting to layer it like maybe a couple of minutes in to the outro. Yeah, but there's no real guitar solo. The bass is uncomplicated. A bit like Let It Be again, the most virtuosic performance really is coming from Paul's singing, which gradually becomes more elaborate and unleashed as the verses progress towards that finale where everyone goes completely nuts. But that's the way it needs to be for a song that has a structure of, I guess it's something like A, B, A, B, A, B, and then just a massive C, you know.
Yes, yeah.
Until you're done. The chords aren't hard to work out. They are, in fact, almost childishly simple once you know how to play basic chord shapes, but stringing them together with that melody, those changes, that arrangement, that mood, and that slide into the repeated building epic coda is genius. And Paul was right to tell George not to play it. I don't think it would have been good, the idea of call and answer guitar on it. I think it wouldn't have worked. So there. I'm going to give it 91 for music because it's Hey Jude.
Can I mention about Ringo? So the drums, which you mentioned about Ringo's brilliant sense of leaving it until they need to come in and then doing those amazing fills. So apparently that on that take that ends up as the main take that was used, Paul began playing and recording, not realising that Ringo wasn't actually behind his drums. He was in the loo.
Right.
And so, you know, just before Ringo's due to come in, Paul recalls sort of this sensation of Ringo sneaking past him to get to his drum kit.
Right.
Just in time for the drums to come in and it being sort of like, oh, that's one of those things that makes it. You know, this is the take because it shouldn't, that shouldn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's great. That John's little verse harmonies are brilliant. And it's just.
Yeah, they're very good, actually. And they're deceptively simple, those ones, because I reckon they'd be quite hard to make sure because there's lots of different ones you could pick. And because they're just the two of them, he has to get that right one. And
it's a very John and Paul relationship that gives rise to such a clever little harmony.
Indeed. So on to the production then. So like the uncomplicated writing of the song in the sense of what they've the adornment and things. I think we have quite an unfussy production for the mm-hmm. most part. The piano sounds very lush, deep and warm, with the sustained pedal, I imagine, all the way to the ground throughout. It's got a real lovely reverb on it. The acoustic guitar fills it out at the top register in the other ear, you know. Yeah. Even the tambourine sounds great in this one.
Well, they went to Trident Studios, you know. So this is one of the weird things with this song, Hey Jude, is for years I never really... And it's the same with a lot of the Beatles singles. I don't necessarily associate them with albums.
No.
But of course, this is the middle of the White Album sessions.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
This is a White Album song.
That's weird. I never thought of it like that.
You know, I find it hard to associate it with that. But of course, while they're doing the White Album, it's like the Abbey Road still hasn't got a fixed 8-track in it. So they know that Trident Studios does. And they like the sound of the speakers for the playback in Trident Studios. Mm. So they keep going there for quite a few songs around this time. And there'll be another one in a bit. So you've got the piano in Trident. You've got Trident's own particular sound. You've got all the various technical qualities of the equipment there that make this sound the way it sounds.
Oh, good. Well, it's Trident Studios. I take it it's obviously in London. Is it?
Yes.
Is it far away from Abbey Road? Is it?
Do you know what? I don't know. I'm going to look it up while you keep talking.
Okay. Well, I'm saying the tambourine sound great. And, you know...
It's in Soho.
Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah, so central London, essentially.
So, yeah, I think obviously the big outro is a huge part of this and the way it builds up. It sounds to me like mainly brass, is it?
Well, I can tell you the orchestration on this is you've got a bunch of strings, you've got a bunch of woodwind, mainly clarinets. Then it's trumpets, trombones, horns, some extra percussion, a couple of double bass.
Yeah.
So it's a mini orchestra. It's a 36-piece orchestra, essentially.
Okay. But they are all essentially mostly just banging out one long note as with each chord change.
Yeah, for each of those chords.
And essentially nearly all playing the same note for the first few times around, and then you start to hear just some others creeping in and later down at the line, which gives that feeling of like a slow build, which is great. And... you know, it's not like his most complicated bit of orchestration, but it would, a bit like George's ideas about putting guitars on it. I don't think it would have made sense for there to be lots of like twiddles going up and down on the strings. It just needs to hit that. What is now, like you said, has been copied or at least, you know, has inspired so many songs to have that kind of three chord sing along big outro, hasn't it?
Yeah.
There's many examples where you just go, well, that's just Hey Jude. You know. So, yeah, one thing I was wondering about before I score it is how long did it go on for? If they hadn't faded it, do we know how long it would have gone on for?
Do you know what? I don't know that off the top of my head. I don't think it was much longer than what actually ends up on the final thing.
Yeah.
Really. My favourite thing about the whole recording session is the fact that they have this 36-piece orchestra. And obviously they want to sing along chorus on it, so there's only going to be a handful of people around in the studio other than these orchestral musicians. So they say to them, well, you've played your orchestra bits. Will you stay and will you sing and clap with us for the outro?
Okay.
So it's all, to which 35 of these 36 musicians say, yeah, that's fine, because they know they're getting musician unions double rates to do that because it's beyond the contract. And one of them is like, no, I'm not doing that. Just goes. She's like, you're... What? Oh, God, I'm not singing on Paul McCartney's song.
What a sour puss, eh?
It's just bizarre being that one person who's like, I didn't bother singing on one of the biggest singles of all time.
That's the definition of there's always one. I'm going to go home. Bored.
I'm not being paid double for this.
well, I'm going to give it 89 for production.
Mm-hmm.
So, lyrics then. I don't think it's going to be much of a revelation to many people listening to this that this song was originally intended for Julian Lennon, but do you want to recap the genesis of it anyway?
Yeah, so the divorce is happening between John and Cynthia, and obviously the child in the mix here is Julian Lennon, who John admittedly didn't spend much time with as a child. And in fact, Julian recalls essentially that he sort of... Paul spent more time with him like a then he's, you know, he just, I don't know whether it's sort of like in an uncle sort of sense, but like a more attentive uncle than his father, his own father was attentive in terms of that. So after, you know, the divorce thing's happening and Paul McCartney thinks, well, I'm going to go and see Cynthia and Julian because, you know, I've known them for years and it's, you know. So apparently he's driving there and he's coming up with this little song which he's calling Hey Jules. And obviously it transmogrifies into Hey Jude, which does work better, I think, as a...
It's the syllable sound in the song.
It's
a necessary change, isn't it? It's not just to disguise ID, it's because it's just a better word to sing.
Apparently he turned up to Cynthia and Julian's house with a single red rose for Cynthia and basically said, how about it, Cynthia? How about you and me? And, you know, just being as sweet can be, really. And, yeah, so it's a song for Julian. It's a song for a child going through a divorce. It's a song for, you know, it's a song for understanding. It's a song for strength. And the funny thing is, even though John knew it was about Julian, John felt it was about him.
Right,
you know, and so
yeah. Well, I think there's a mixed message a bit, isn't there? Because when it says you are found and now go and get it, that doesn't sound. It would be a strange bit of advice to give Julian.
Yes, indeed, and I think John can hear.
Yeah.
Paul singing that to him about Yoko, or so he believed.
Yeah.
So.
And that's the thing, that they're under your skin. I always found that first verse, knowing the root of the song, a bit confusing because is he saying, you know, because obviously Cynthia's his mother and he's with her, and like that, that's his family unit. So it's not Paul saying, you know, really kind of like throw yourself into the Yoko stepmom relationship type of thing. I don't think that's right, but I think it settles down in the second and third verses into what he means to say to Julian.
Yeah.
And the first one possibly maybe is a bit more John. That would make more sense because that's... You know, he's kind of...
Again, a song's origins are not its final story.
No, exactly.
Unless he decided, I'm going to... As we'll see, again, with another one coming up in here, it's...
Yeah.
Just because it's got a particular origin doesn't mean it's about that thing, literally.
No, it's just a starting point for...
Otherwise, we lose the universality, we lose the...
Well, otherwise, you just have a script of something that... You wouldn't write a song, you'd just write all the words down that you actually said and just give them to people. There'd be no art, would there? They'd just be literal translations of things that happened to people's ears and eyes. So, but it's like a lot of Macca songs and songs in general, sometimes close inspection isn't warranted because it word for word, it might not always make some sense, but you do get these gems in the middle of it. I mean, the line, it's a fool who plays it cool by making his world a little colder is brilliant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't you know that it's just you'll do. I mean, that's sound advice to anybody. All good sentiments.
And the movement you need is on your shoulder.
Yeah.
I'll change that. You won't, you know. You know. I just love that. That's one of those oft, you know, most repeated Paul stories, isn't it? About John saying, oh, I like that line, even though it doesn't make sense. Yeah. It makes sense to me. And Paul saying, oh, I'll leave it in then, you know.
Oh. Yeah, I've never thought of it. Movement you need on your shoulder. It does make sense to me as well. I've just always
I think it makes sense to everyone, even though actually when you break it down, it doesn't. Yeah. No one says, oh, you've got the movement you need on your shoulder.
What's that on your shoulder? It's the movement.
It's like a parrot.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's...
Yeah, I know. It's weird, isn't it? I guess because you get... Yeah, I never thought of that. Well, I'm going to be thinking about that for ages now. So, and of course, we get the very poignant na-na-na-na-na-na-na's.
Yes.
Setting a template for non-language kind of refrains for decades to come. Although they did exist before this, because Land of a Thousand Dances, for example.
We do also get, Gary, sorry, which before we sort of you give any scores, at 2 minutes 58 seconds. I don't know whether you want to bleep this. But of course, at 2 minutes 58 seconds in the Beatles single Hey Jude, someone says f***ing hell.
I thought I heard that.
You did hear it.
I will bleep it.
In case there's any little ones listening.
Yeah, but I thought I heard something like that. And I thought, is this the one where, I know there's a couple of examples of sweary Beatles, isn't there?
Yeah, but not, this is the most prominent.
It's mad. Well, I'm not scoring that. I'm not going to... penalise it for it either. But the words pivoting around a novel idea of delivery, you know, advice to a child going through a divorce, very, very unique, have gone down in history for good reason. I'm going to give it 89 for lyrics, which gives it 89.7 overall.
Brilliant.
So next week, what?
Well, the trousers.
Oh, what? Hang on. It's the Ruttles. Oh, well, they've cropped up here, Gary, because of the outro of this song.
Okay.
So the song is Shangri-La from the Archaeology album in 1996. But it's actually a redone Neil Innes song from the 70s that she's turned into a Ruttles song. So it's full of Beatles-y things. But the reason we've included it here, and I'm sure actually when we do a Ruttles roundup at some point, I'll give Shangri-La more attention because it deserves it. But the outro here is la-di-doo-da, la-di-da, here we are in Shangri-La.
Yeah.
And it runs to 7 minutes and 43 seconds, so it's longer than Hey Jude. But this was the single that came out when Archaeology was released.
Ah, okay.
As I had it on cassette single, which I bought from HMV in Hanley.
I seem to remember it. I remember
a little cardboard slip. It got to number 68 on the charts.
Wow. There you
go. But it's such a great song. You know, I mean, all the early versions of this that you see, Neil, because there's a couple of live performances of this. I think he's done it on Saturday Night Live, and he did it on the Frankie Howard Show, things like that, back in the 70s and 80s. And
It deserves its full 7.5 minutes because I think off the top of my head, listen to it, you've got Day in the Life,
yes,
Maxwell's Silver Hammer, Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields, Fool on the Hill, I'm the Walrus, Mr. Kite,
and of course, it's got everything in it. It's a proper kitchen sink.
It is like if the Ruttles had only existed in one song, it would have been...
It could have been that version.
It could have been this one, as far as representing the second half of the Beatles career, if you know what I mean.
Plus, it has the Mickey take of Whatever by Oasis at the beginning as a sort of like, ha ha ha, Neil Innes owns some of your song.
Yeah, yeah. Because from How Sweet to Be an Idiot. Well,
but, yeah. And also, just before we wrap that one up, though, it's also, I believe, that when Paul was producing the Bonzo Dog Band single, I'm the Urban Spaceman, which he did under the name Apollo C. Vermouth, during that session, he said, you know, they've only got so much studio time booked, but Paul comes in, sits down at the piano and says, I've just written this song, and it's Hey Jude. So...
Right.
So the Bonzos would have heard this whilst thinking, oh, blimey, we've only got so much time in this studio here.
Nice. Well, first-hand experience then.
Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you, Ruttles. Next, we have Flying. Flying, Paul.
Aerial Tour Instrumental, Gary, as it's subtitled on the Magical Mystery Tour stuff. It's our theme tune.
It is our theme tune. And that another one would have been...
Our copyright baiting theme tune.
Hey, shush, shush. It would have been another good one to end on, in a way.
It would have.
But it's yeah.
So anyway, it's an instrumental that turns up on the Magical Mystery Tour, well, in the film, obviously, but it's on the EP, which comes out in the UK on the 8th of December, 67, and the LP, which is now the official discography version of Magical Mystery Tour, on the 27th of December, 1967.
Mm-hmm.
It's recorded on the 8th of September, and there's a bit of a gap in the 28th of September, 67, something like that. Mainly on one session, really, I think, and it's just born out of them having a jam, but... The thing with Beatles jams is they tend to be rubbish. You know, when they just try and do like bluesy jams, it's rubbish. When they try and do sort of weirdy psyche jams,
it's cool. Interesting stuff comes out of it.
Yeah. And even this is trimmed down from a much, much longer version.
Yeah.
It's got lots of tape loops and backward sounds, mellotrons used in all sorts of different ways to it. And then it does have some vocals on it with Ringo being very prominent. As well, because this is credited to Lennon, McCartney, Harrison, Starkey.
Okay, is this the only one that is?
I think No, because we've got Maggie May as traditional, isn't it? Arranged Lennon, McCartney, Harrison, Starkey.
So this is one of two, maybe, or very few.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. It is strange to hear this without my own voice coming in over the top of it now. when I went to listen to it.
You have a Pavlovian reflex whenever you hear it.
I just have to go, hello, welcome to the Big Beatles. Yeah, yeah, it just confused me when I listened to it for doing my notes. I thought, what have I done? I know I'm listening to the song. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd triggered my own podcast. Anyway, I may have slightly ruined it for myself forever because of that, but it's nice to actually hear it progress past the first few bars, really, and actually have a good listen to it again. I like also how this is the one and only instrumental, isn't it, in their entire catalogue, I think.
Yeah, really, yeah.
I mean, we have things with silly vocals and bits and bobs of vocals, but this is, and I know this has got backing vocals, but it's an instrumental, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's nothing, it's strange, really, that they didn't...
Because every other time they tried to do instrumental stuff, it just turned out like the 12-bar original, which is tedious.
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry, Beatles, that's not the sort of band you are.
No. But yeah, it's just funny they didn't do more. And it's very slight and lovely as it is, with the mellowness of the flying motif working its way through the music into a kind of spooky / ambient outro. But what do we have really? I mean, it's a nice guitar lick and bass line with some lovely picking over the top. And is it some organ? What is it that does the main melody? What is that?
Well, you've got layers of stuff here. So John on a sort of Hammond organ, but then several layers of mellotrons. And the main mellotron thing is the trombone sound they're using for
That's actually that mellotron. Yeah, they've got some, you know, the chorus of voices, not particularly doing any, by their standards, huge, amazing harmonies, but just kind of belting it out, really, just belting out the melody again in a kind of male voice choir style.
Yeah.
It is them, isn't it, doing it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
They all sing on it.
I didn't realise it was a jam, and you've confirmed it is, because it has that kind of feeling.
Well, it's born out of a jam. It's obviously more, you know, arranged by the time it comes to being.
But it's not completely, totally arranged by the time, because there are bits that sound a little uncertain on the fly. Kind of, it hangs together for 2 minutes, and they kind of, it's like, there's a bit where you start to get a feeling of this could all just stop, and then it kind of does. And then
they cut it basically, because if they listen to the long version, which you can find on bootlegs, it's like they start doing all sorts of stuff with the mellotron. So mellotrons would have also not just the sound tapes for the particular instruments. I'm not going to go on what a mellotron is, but it plays tapes of sounds when you press the keys, but it also played tapes of anything. So several keys could be set on the mellotron to play like backing tracks.
Yeah.
So you could settle for company.
Yeah.
So if you listen to the full version of this, after it fades out of the bit we know, it goes into sort of like automated backing track stuff,
like single fingers
as it carries on, and then there's more backwards stuff and more other tape loops and things going around the place.
It gets, there's a feeling of a kind of like it's much looser than one of the
I like the idea of it being John and Ringo off doing the tape loops, though. I like, you know, coming up with those weird bits and pieces to fly in a little bit, like sort of Tomorrow Never Knows sound effects type thing.
I mean, I obviously like it, as I chose it for our intro and outro music, not just because it's instrumental, because I could have done that, I could have picked instrumental bits of all the other songs, but it has a nice mellow ambience that I think sets the tone for what we're doing here. And I've always enjoyed it, but it is slight and it is a bit thrown together sounding in places. So I'm going to give it 48 for music. Production, then. I find the hard panning on this a bit strange in the mixes that you listen to now. It takes a little while before everything kind of comes in and starts to fill it all out. But once it's all there, it kind of settles in. Yeah. I feel like you can hear it off mic singing or something that's been scrubbed off for takes or something coming in before the actual singing does.
You weren't on it, Gary. No, it's not you.
But am I right? Obviously.
Well, there's all sorts of stuff, and they've tried flying things in a bit. And there'll probably be noises in the background. And
I feel like I can hear the echo of singing before the singing comes in.
Well, maybe.
So,
maybe.
And it feels like something starts to drop out a bit towards the end, and the vocals surge, and it starts to go a bit like, shall we end it now, lads, type of feel to it.
Yeah.
Which obviously is because there's a production choice to kind of capture it at the stage they were at rehearsing wise and think, well, yeah, we'll do it and we'll do something here, and we'll, and like you say, they went off and did something else and they thought, no, we're not gonna do that. So they were kind of they were kind of editing it with on the board rather than in the room, if you know what I mean. We've got some stuff down. We'll figure something out with it all at the desk.
Yeah, and apparently Jeff Emmerich sort of recalls that they deliberately made Ringo's voice more prominent in the mix to give it a less Beatle-y sound, sort of to aim more for that sort of weird male voice choir effect that you've mentioned, rather than it be classic Beatles harmonies or anything like that. Sort of is almost on lead vocals in this, in a way.
Hey, good stuff. So it's you do get the cool bit end bit with the... So you're saying the tape loops and some strange suspended kind of whistling almost sound going on, sustained
noise. Yeah, lots of sort of organ overdubs and reversed sounds and stuff like that in there. Just, they're having a smoke and a silly time, essentially.
They're twiddling knobs and trying effects out and things and just like, what happens if I do this? It's got a bit of meat, because I do think that end bit's got some nice little bits in it. But it feels a little bit Halfway House-ish, so I'm going to give it 52 for production.
Mm-hmm.
And as the only words are not any, that makes sense, 33.3 overall. I feel a bit bad for it, but it's a little ditty, really.
We picked this low-scoring one and we picked it as our theme.
As our theme, but it served us well.
Yeah, and, no, it's great. It's if you had a category for mood or ambience.
Yeah, it's cool.
And this is us discussing it outside of the context of the film as well. Yeah, because it does a job in the film.
It's got a thrilling black and white flying sequence to it. If you were watching it at the time,
if you're watching it on the or at the time,
watching it as it was intended, a multicolour psychedelic flying experience, which is just, I think that's one of the moments in the film that really highlights how they got it wrong with having it broadcast in black and white,
in black and white.
Sorry?
They didn't want it broadcast in black and white.
No, I know they didn't,
but
I mean, like, how it went wrong for it to be broadcast in black and white when there's a whole sequence of clouds, flying past a camera, which are meant to be, rotating
nicked
through
off
all
the cutting room floor from the Doctor Strangelove movie.
Yeah, but, anyway.
Quick Ruttles mention, though, Gary.
Okay.
Not a proper Ruttles one, but. This is another one we'll scoop up in the Ruttles Roundup at some point, but there's a song called We've Arrived, and to prove it, we're here. In fact, we've talked about it back in the USSR, haven't we? But the end of that collapses into a sort of parody of flying.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it folds down into sort of, I'll try to do it then now, but I'm thinking of this one. So, carry on.
Yeah, okay. Well, yes. you can stop now.
Throw that in.
Next, then. It won't be long.
Every night when everybody has fun, here am I sitting all on my own. It won't be long, it won't be long, it won't be long, till
it won't be long, Paul.
Well, it won't be long, Gary, until this first part of our series finishes.
No.
We're rapidly running out of Beatles songs.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is one that we have got to do from With the Beatles. In fact, the opening track of With the Beatles, second album, 22nd of November 1963, that comes out. This is recorded on the 30th of July 1963. So you've got a very typical lineup of early Beatles of bass, two guitars, drums, and then vocals and a couple of bits of doubling on guitars and voices. And the word yeah being very prominent here, of course. And it's a track I'm very keen on, but it's a track that for many years I only knew in a really abridged form. I think I'd mentioned this somewhere else on the podcast. So the copy of With the Beatles I got, which our cousin Jeanette got for me sometime early 90s, maybe, perhaps even before then. It's only got one scratch on it. It's on this first track. So this sort of, it's like it was just like a severe edit in the middle of it. It just skips. Right. It gets so far in and then suddenly it's just like, glen, 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 ooh, and it's done.
Right.
So for years I only knew it in that sort of abridged, knackered form.
Oh.
Good album opener. Could have been a single, I think. Any other group would have wanted it as a single. But, yeah.
That's exactly my opening note, is that I've always loved this one and wondered why it didn't or doesn't occupy the same kind of space as She Loves You and Can't Buy Me Love. I guess because it didn't get released as a single, but, you know, that's what they're for, why it's not as known as well. But it has a strong rocky chorus with the good old yeahs, call and response of the time that they they used well. Some nice verses with classic Beatles kind of echo chamber style backing vocals, you know, the being repeated, the lead vocal. And a catchy guitar riff coming in here and there. A good solid beat and bass backing, keeping up a great tempo. And it's a neat, well-played, catchy, rocky number, which I kind of wonder why it wasn't a single, really.
I think it's tricky to figure this out because, it's a Lennon-originated song. Mm. And it was an attempt at writing a single. But somehow it's like when they try and write a single, they don't quite manage it. And it always feels like with things that become singles, they seem to have emerged without the story of we were trying to write a single.
Yeah, and if you could point at another single that came out around this time and said, well, that this should have been it instead of that. I mean, I guess it goes to say something that they had songs, so many good songs, that they could have something that would be easily be a single just as the album opener.
Yeah, it's just bonkers. But the thing is, She Loves You is miles above this somehow.
Hmm.
And I can't quite work out why. Well, I can work out why, but that's a whole other discussion. But I think the simple fact is, I love the sound of it. I think it's a great sounding record.
Mm.
It's got, some good energy going on for the sort of yeahs and things like that. Any other group releasing this as a single would have been made up.
Yeah, yeah.
Backing vocals are amazing. John's vocal style and technique is brilliant.
Yeah.
But I don't think they liked it.
Oh, well.
I just don't think the band liked it.
Mm.
That's reading between the lines. I just like... Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. I think it's great. And actually, although I understand why She Loves You and Can't Buy Me Love were the biggest songs and made the better singles because of their something about their overall appeal to their audience and demographic, for me personally, I prefer this song. It suits my particular taste, my particular unique tastes, Paul. It's 65 for music I'm giving it.
Yeah. Well, keep this in mind. So... there's no live performances of this, and there's no radio performances. They never bothered.
They just wrote this, played, recorded it.
Wrote it, recorded it, it was done. Never they did a mimed that. Performance of it on Ready, Steady, Go, which you can just about hunt out on YouTube still.
Okay.
And they barely know the song. They put no energy into the miming performance. John barely knows the words, and you can just see him laughing all the way through it and pulling faces. They don't put any energy into it.
Okay.
So it's like... that they did the one mimed performance. But again, the funny way these episodes fall for us, I'll be saying something very similar again in this episode.
Okay. Foreshadowing. Very nice. So on to production then, because I said the music 65. Yeah, production. I really love the cold start into this from the vocal hook. And everything joining a split second later. I love the balance of the main vocal and the more distant backing answering it. Because John's really prominent up there at the top, along with the lead guitar as well, with that descending little riff that it does. And there's times when that doubles with the bass.
Yeah.
And it sounds so chunky and lovely. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
They do these cool little unison bits, don't they, between them, just as they go...
Perhaps an early clue to the new direction of them having doubled up bass parts later in later years.
Ah, it does sound great. And it only happens for like a half bar before the change of section or something. And if you listen to Out For It, you'll just get that great tonality that emerges from guitars and bass playing in unison. And it's really cool. Sometimes the backing vocals dip a bit too quiet. That's the only thing I found in the verses.
My feeling is that the one thing that needed to be heavier in the mix was the drums. And by heavier, I mean the low end of the drums. The kick's quite lost.
Okay.
And it's very hi-hat dominant. So it's very bright hi-hat in the mix.
And
I was listening on bassy headphones today to this. And it's, so I'd have liked the drums. I mean, they did 10 takes of the basic backing track.
Yeah.
Picked number 7 to be the best one. Then they spent the afternoon of that session that they were doing this in, doing these superimpositions of the lead vocals and guitars.
Mm.
And then they had to do an edit piece of the band together to stick on to make the end better.
Mm.
So I get the feeling that essentially... they wrote it. It was slightly more complicated than they could be bothered with, and the fact that they couldn't just do it in a couple of performances in the studio and had to do a load of sticking it together stuff put them off it totally. So
okay, I'm still going to give it 65 for production because I think it sounds great.
It's good for the era, I think. But yeah.
So lyrics then. I never twigged to the double meaning of belong and belong.
No, it's just it's not a double meaning. It's just wordplay. You know, I mean, Paul McCartney talks about this in his in the Many Years From Now book, and sort of says, well, that's a song where it sort of demonstrates my or our tendencies towards being a bit literary and using double meanings or wordplay. So like belong, belong. Well, which is sort of, you know, comes to its peak in Blue Jay Way, I suppose. Those exact words. Don't belong. Or something like, I think I read one today that was a good example of it, which was in Good Morning, Good Morning, in Somebody Needs to Know the Time, Glad the Time Here. So you hear the joke of that word, glad that I'm the time, the time.
The time. Here.
Yeah, sort of nice little, the things that make for the nice little cadences within a sentence or within a line. And this is the sort of, you know, an example of that belong, belong, but
yeah. Well. Yeah, but we don't have much else to get stuck into.
No.
Tears rolling down from eyes every night as I cry every night when everybody has fun. Here I am sitting out on my own.
Well, John's doing that voice that he uses on Anna and when he's doing the cover versions. Yeah. He's doing that thing, so like famously in this one, he rhymes the word more with the word no. You won't need me no more.
Yeah. Well, fun and own doesn't rhyme. Usually very good with rhyming, but he gets away with it from the sheer confidence of how he performs it. And actually, you can just not rhyme lines if you want to. It actually doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not the most amazing lyrics, but they make for a great chorus. And that kind of hook that you need for a song to have its own identity. I'm going to give it 43 for lyrics, which gives it 57.7 overall.
Righto.
Next, Martha, my dear.
Hold your head up, you silly girl. Look what you've done. When you find yourself in the thick of it, help yourself to a better what is all around you. Silly girl, take a
Martha, my dear, Paul.
Martha, my dear. I'm just trying to work out where the comma would go in that sentence. Martha, my dear Paul. No, it doesn't work. Got nothing on that one.
Okay.
Right. So, a White Album track. So, this is interesting because we've talked about Hey Jude being essentially a White Album track. Well, it's not off on the album, but it's off the sessions.
Yeah.
This is another McCartney piano-led thing from the White Album sessions, recorded at Trident Studios again. But a very different piece.
Yeah.
It's very different.
Blow my mind, Hey Jude, being a White Album song. But go on.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? So White Album comes out on the 22nd of November 1968. This is recorded on the 4th and 5th of October at 68 in Trident, like I say. And again, it's Paul on the piano with a little mini orchestra stuck onto it. But here we've basically got Paul doing an exercise. So whereas, like, Hey Jude, you said completely correctly, it's basically the basic obvious chords you can sit and play at a piano
that'll
give you thousands of songs under your fingers.
Yeah.
This is McCartney deliberately trying to write something more complicated for himself as a piano player, a self-taught piano player. It's in E flat for a start, which is a silly one, which means you're all on your black notes for the main part. Mm-hmm. And it is a little bit complicated. It's not something you'd instinctively play, yeah. I don't think. And it's a whole totally different feel. No Lennon on this one at all. And, yeah, song about a dog, innit?
I mean, this is very different from Hey Jude. And, I think you've characterised that perfectly. In that, yeah, you wouldn't stumble upon Martha, my dear. You might stumble upon at least three or four of the chords in Hey Jude in the same order that Hey Jude's written in. You wouldn't do this unless you were setting out to try something and what happens if I don't just kind of go where the kind of natural chord takes me to and things and see how that works. And you end up with something as cool as the piano on this. I love that piano intro, which basically tells you what you need to know about the song in one round, doesn't it?
Well,
not everything, actually. It tells you what you need to know about the first section of the song, because this is another interestingly arranged ABC type song rather than a kind of A-B-A-B type of thing. So yeah, I love how it bounces along to those kind of novel chords with all of its White Album 1920s music hall-y jazz type of feel.
Yeah, it's still got some of that in there. I don't think it quite... it's not Honey Pie,
No, it's not full Honey Pie. It's kind of honey...
Which does the whole thing very authentically. Yeah. Authentically in speech marks, as always. But it's more akin to that world than it is to the rock world, save for George having that great bit of electric guitar on it. So, you know, he's just playing electric guitar chords with distortion or overdrive, so it gives it the White Album sensation.
Yeah. It's just a little less Honey Pie-ish, a little less affected, but he still feels like he's got that bouncing around at the time that he wrote this kind of thing. Something's, you know... it's in his head, that kind of style. Mm. But yeah, we're joined by the strings in the A section eventually after a couple of rounds of the piano. Then the brass in the B section.
Yeah.
And only kind of get the bouncy, rounded bass and swinging drums in the kind of C section with a take a good look around you bit when we get into full swing, really get going and kind of build to a lovely falsetto climax in the vocal. And then into a full-on instrumental verse. With the full ensemble and horns taking the lead, back into a C-section without the big build this time. Then strangely Ringo drops out, but we still have the bass. And we kind of go, we step down to an ending like that, you know, bits come out of it and it ends up pretty much on a kind of a you know, your strings, isn't it?
Well, it ends on the bass guitar essentially, just going bom, bom,
oh, yeah.
Bom,
yeah.
Bom. Note I can't sing because it's too low.
Yeah, with it. Oh, that's it, because it's got its crisp little octaves, hasn't it? Top end bits that it's doing. And then end. And there's this weird song that I can only describe by talking about how it's arranged, because it's kind of ebbs and swells. It's carried forward on its unique kind of round of unusual chords and its mesh of these sections. It's a real cool song. I love it. What's the guitar doing in it?
It's just playing chords, essentially, for the most part.
I don't know if I pick up on that so much. I hear the piano, the bass and drums.
No, it's there. It's nice and clear, Gary.
Yeah. I just can't bring it to mind.
Get your guitar ears on.
Yeah, I mustn't have my guitar ears on. I'm going to give it 69 for music anyway.
Right.
Production, then. There's some more strange pannings going on here, don't you think? The strings are kind of hard left.
Well, what's happened there is, so we're back at Trident Studios again, and we've got the 8-track available to them. Okay. And so they've got the ability here to do some stuff. Rather than have to record the strings and the brass and woodwind all together, they can record them separately and have them very clear and separate and pan them wide. So you've got essentially 2 tracks for the horns and woodwind, I think, and then 1 track for the strings. So you can have one very far panned to the left, one very far panned to the right. And they don't cross over and there's no bleed or sort of studio space sound binding them together. So it's if they feel separate and wide. That makes sense?
Yes, it does. Indeed. It loses the thickness of the strings a bit than being over in the left. But it does make room for the brass part over in the right. And when it's all together, it makes sense again. But when they're not all together, you feel like, what are you doing over there? kind of thing. A little bit. But actually for the White Album... it's very neat, almost peppery style production, I think. You know, it's not quite, but it's getting kind of going back to that bit with the drums and bass playing beautifully together in the mix and the piano and orchestra accompaniment flowing seamlessly around them in the main vocal part. Not really any, there's no harmonies to deal with, is there at all in this? So,
no.
And I say I didn't pick up the guitar, but I guess it's not doing anything.
I'm not lying, Gary.
I'm not saying you're lying. I'm
not
saying
you're lying.
It doesn't stand out, kind of thing.
So it's textural chords. But it's nice. I like it. It's a good guitar sound of the era.
Yeah, it's I think the skill for this song, and it's relatively straightforward in some ways, but the skill is the accompaniment, which again is excellent and typical in that it's perfectly suited to the style and feel of the song.
Especially with George Martin doing another good job.
Probably with
no time at all to do it in.
And the big brassy bass notes kind of helping it to bop along a bit as well.
One of the things that gives it a bit of a 1920s feel is having like the tuba doing doubling the bass at certain points, which is a very, you know, something that would have happened in jazz jazz ensembles of sorts.
To boost up that low end in because there wouldn't be amplified
bass instruments at the time. So
absolutely. I'm going to give it 78 for production.
Right. Can I mention something really production-y here?
Yeah, of course you can.
Just because we've been talking about Trident.
Mm.
And sometimes I've mentioned about songs, that they record songs in different studios, feeling like they're from a different studio. They've got slightly different... There's something.
Mm.
So I think it's very easy to understand that if you record something in a different place, there's going to be... There's so many things in the way between you making a noise and it being recorded and it being recorded and being pressed to disc that can affect the sound.
Okay.
So it's all the electronics, it's all the microphones, it's all the size and shape of the room, all that sort of stuff that we all know about. We can understand that, that studios aren't clones of each other, so they're always going to sound different.
Yeah.
And then the but in Trident, one of the reasons the Beatles loved going there was because it had these amazing monitors, which sounded really, so everything sounded really great when they played it back to themselves.
Yeah.
There, but Trident did a lot of work with tapes from America.
Okay.
So it's very popular with like doing mixing of tapes from America. So they were set up for a different noise profile, a different EQ curve.
Mm.
So they take these things, so the Beatles would record there and it sound fantastic in Trident, but they'd go over to EMI Studios, Abbey Road, and they used a different EQ noise standard, which means that when they played the tapes back in Abbey Road, it didn't sound as good as it did in Trident.
Right.
Because Trident was set up to record and sound one way, and output material in one way. Abbey Road was different. So Trident were using a US standard, Abbey Road was using a UK European standard. This is basically about how the sound you've recorded is affected post, post then, in general terms. And it gets very, very loopy and you can go and look up pictures of noise profiles. The idea is to try and minimise tape hiss.
Okay.
Essentially. But it works differently around the world and standards are different and there's engineering standards to this day that you sort of refer to.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So they were, was it like constantly frustrating them that they'd go back and they're like, but this isn't what it was like? Did they?
Yeah, well,
they
so with Martha, my dear, I think, and I think with Hey Jude as well, when they get it to sort of, to processing it in Abbey Road, they're then having to do a load of extra EQing to balance out
to get it back to what they were hearing
through the speakers and the system in Trident.
It's a minefield. It's even a minefield now when you mix things and then you listen to it, like you were saying about having bassy headphones. It's like,
yeah, yeah,
the struggle
yeah.
is real. You know, you mix on.
There's so well. There's so many things. And, yeah, so many things can affect it. And in those days, it was so many big chunky electronic things that took real engineers to understand.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's kind of like, oh, I've got to mix it so if someone's listening through their stupid tinny phone speaker.
Yeah,
like
that sort of stuff.
Like that.
So that's my big production note here is that when they get, you know, the reason things sounds, I sometimes say stuff sounds different is because I think it does. Mm. They have different qualities.
Oh, yeah, different studios, definitely, yeah.
Even if it's the same musicians with the same instruments and the same producer.
Yeah.
So there, let's get on to lyrics.
Okay, lyrics then. So we all know how Paul likes to write songs about dogs. is this his first song
now,
about
anyway.
A dog?
Yes, it is, yeah.
But it won't
so
be his last?
He'd not long had his, I think a couple of years, he'd had this sheepdog called Martha.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to know it about a dog to enjoy it as a silly little love song to someone called Martha, if you wanted. The only thing that would have given it away if he'd changed the kind of take a good look around you to, who's a good girl then? And, but anyway, yeah, it's...
Well, hold your hand out, you silly girl, is a bit, would be a bit weird to say to a human.
But, yeah, I guess so, yeah.
But look what you've done.
You wouldn't call it a paw.
But, you know, again, this is what I was saying earlier about Hey Jude or Hey Jules.
Yeah.
You can take an origin, a name, a person, and a thought, an idea,
and make it
and turn
better.
It into something else. So he didn't literally, he's not literally meaning this about the dog.
No, of course not.
But it is about the dog. So.
Yeah, but then he does Jet and things, and like he obviously thought, I can nail this song about a dog, malarkey. Yeah, it somehow retains the feel of the music hall love song whilst being about a German shepherd. That's
it's an old English sheepdog, not a German shepherd.
Oh, I thought, where did I get German shepherd from? I've just made that up. This is why I have you, Paul. Otherwise, yeah. I just pick dog breeds from thin air.
Yeah,
yeah so yeah, 57 for lyrics. I'm going to give it. So that's 68 overall.
Hmm.
Next week... What?
Well, the trousers.
Oh, it's them Ruttles again.
What are they up to now?
They're up to another day.
At times like these, when enemies can number more than friends, a friend indeed is what I need, not someone who pretends.
So, it's the White Album piano pastiche song of the original Ruttles album, or the Ruttles film. And so it's not lyrically the same as Martha, My Dear, but the piano part is a tribute to that style of playing.
Yeah.
So it's more of a sort of general Macca White Album vibe thing, isn't it?
It is.
With, yeah, and it has the same thing with the strings and the brass sort of panned wide to sound like this. But it's brilliant. Oh, I just love Another Day.
It's a lovely
Any song that's got the line, "You're so pusillanimous, oh yeah," in it, it's just, what lyrics?
It's, I mean, like I say, the start's very Martha, My Dear, but the verses are much less jolly and it's much more melancholic, isn't it? And lovely in that, in its way.
Yeah, which I find a lot of Neil's stuff to be slightly melancholic, yeah. I find. You know, humorous, brilliant, but often with a little tear rolling down the corner of your eye.
And this is one where I think it's almost at the point, if he wasn't doing it for the Ruttles, where you wouldn't know again, unless you said, oh yeah, I listened to Martha, My Dear, and I thought, I'd like to do something a bit like that. And I think you'd go, fair enough. You wouldn't go, oh, you've copied it. It's like, oh, yeah, I see. You've thought that's a nice way to kind of arrange and, you know, to score an instrument, a track, and you've written your own one, and that's what it sounds. Because it's a complete song in its own right, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a lovely song. It's really nice to sit and listen to it. I've heard it before, but I don't listen to them as much as yourself, so it was really nice. This and Shangri-La. So, yeah, he was a clever chap.
Yeah, he was.
So, finally then, Paul, 8 days a week.
Oh, I need your love, babe. Guess you know it's true. Hope you need my love, babe. Just like I need you. Hold me, love.
8 days a week, Paul.
Is that week W-E-A-K? Because, you know, I have my moments of feeling very limp, very poor. No, shut up, Albert. 8 days a week, off Beatles for Sale, which comes out on the 4th of December 1964. Not a single in the UK, but a single in America.
Mm.
So it comes out on the 15th of February 1965 and it becomes their seventh number one in America, which means it gets a place on the number one compilation, the One compilation.
Yeah.
Which is annoying because Please Please Me isn't on it, even though it did get to number one in a chart in the UK. Ugh!
But they kind of got all pedantic about the charts.
Yeah, about
which chart was the official one and things.
Yeah, exactly. And so this gets a place on the One compilation, which gives it a sort of, sort of panders to the American fan base and market, which is understandable, you know. Because again, we're talking about a song that if we put aside the fact that it was a single in America, it feels strange again that this wasn't a single here.
Yeah.
But I think almost exactly the same issues plague this song as plague one we were talking about before.
Yeah.
You know, it won't be long. When you start looking at some of the information around it. So it's...
Okay. Well, we'll get into some of that.
It's a great song. It's got great bass line. Mm. Lovely hand claps on this one. Hand claps are good. Great vocal arrangement.
But you just think maybe they weren't. They just
again. I don't. Think
They weren't
thought,
as into it, and they were trying to write a single, and they that
exactly.
Didn't. Okay, I don't have thought of that because this one was a single in America. So I mean, is it unique having a fade in? Oh, have we got that? It's quite.
It is by this point. It's first one. I think.
It's quite unusual, even by the end, isn't it? They don't do many like that. With the kind of high register bass and guitar doing that moving riff thing, which is cool.
having replaced the vocal harmony thing that you can hear on the anthology version, where they try to do a really long ooh note, which you could sort of hear them sort of running out of breath while they're doing it.
Yeah, I'm glad they've ditched that for this because it's a great intro. The big feature for me on this song has always been the walking bass line and the unusual folky harmony chorus that it introduces into rock and roll. The kind of 8 days a week, finger in the ear type of feel to it.
Yeah, it is a different voice. I agree, it's a different voice. I don't think it's quite like that. But
no, I was folking it up then.
You were you gonna bleep that?
No. But without the bass line and that kind of vocally refrain, I don't think the song would work half as well. Although I do like the choppy electric guitar chords and the acoustics kind of simply strumming the chords out throughout. But I think the bass and the drums are really carrying it along.
Mm.
They're really giving it a nice shuffle and feel. Great use of hand claps. So some further layers to up the feel and the motion of the song. Keeps you kind of tapping and wanting to move to it. It's almost a compelling kind of rhythm. And over it all those harmonies. Quite a simple but effective melody that almost stays still whilst the music moves. It's a bit in that way.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's an interesting one on the vocals. There's a bit of debate over who's singing bits and pieces of this. And obviously it's mainly John with John, I think.
Yeah, okay.
But then it's John with Paul. And there's some people don't think George is on it at all, but I think he is in it. I think he's there in the bridge sections.
Doing the Hold Me.
Just the bridge sections, the 8 days. And also any time that the actual the title line crops up, I think he's on there for that as well. But it's as always, it's when you get the Beatle vocal mix, it's very often hard to pull them apart, isn't it, as singers?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, very hard. It's not as unleashed as other singles from that era. It's more kind of tempered, composed in a way. But it's a very enjoyable listen and has nice added clever bits with the intro and outro and that stuff.
Yeah,
I'm going to give it 63 for music. Production then. One thing I was going to ask you about this, so this is, what album is this off again?
Beatles for Sale.
So with It Won't Be Long, how different would their experience of the studio have been by this point compared to Please Please Me? So obviously Please Please Me, great big one day, do everything, boys, get it done.
Yeah.
How different in the space of one album would it have been for them when they were coming to record these things? You've already said that John would have been double tracking with himself a bit.
Well, I mean, so, you know, we're a little way down the way here, aren't we? So we've had Please Please Me, we've had With the Beatles, we've had Hard Day's Night. We get to Beatles for Sale.
Mm.
And so, when I talked about It Won't Be Long, that was recorded in, you know, that had lots of time allocated to it.
Mm.
So they've gone, you know, by this point, it's not full on Pepper moving into the studio for months. And they're still fitting in recording sessions between other engagements, live work, filming, this, that, the other, whatever it is. But obviously, they're spending more time on the things they want to spend more time on, but also still haven't meet deadlines.
Mm.
But I think the interesting thing about you asking me that question is this is supposedly, 8 days a week, is supposedly the first unfinished song that they take into the studio to finish.
Okay. Oh, I see. So that's a turning point in how they...
Yeah, they how they finish approach
songs
in
their practice room as such. Or
which I don't think they had, really. They didn't only have... You know, their practice was hotel rooms and things, but they'd come in and work up arrangements. But apparently this is one that it was... More unfinished, I suppose, would be probably a fairer way of saying.
So they're working it out with the tape running, kind of almost a bit like, let's try this. They're affording studio time.
Yeah,
because time is
money, you know. But they've started to prove, of course, that give them more time, they will make you more money.
Mm. Yeah, but you'd have thought so by this point, wouldn't you? That's why I was wondering how different it got. We're still kind of at the end of the early era.
Yeah.
And you wonder, and the songs could almost have been on any of those first few albums, because this doesn't mark a massive gear shift in how they write songs, but you could imagine it you know, maybe not Please Please Me, but not far away from it, you know.
No, no, absolutely. And like the walking bass line has got that sort of All My Loving feel to it.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Except All My Loving's got more energy.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? I like the hand claps throughout. There's something which is hard to do in production without sounding flappy or thin. Flappy, flabby, flappy, thin. You know, all these adjectives that work for hand claps. So I think that's good. I like the wash that the cymbals give over the whole mix in the verses, and when it's notable when it's not there, so that you get like that space. I think it's quite nicely done. Do you think there's any faults or?
No, nothing particularly. I mean, I will quote a friend of ours and say it's fine. It's basically fine. Which is going to sort of annoy so many listeners, because this is a big, important song for a lot of people. But I've never had the experience of it, partly because it was never a single, so it was never on any of the compilations over here particularly. And I didn't listen to Beatles for Sale for a very long time. It was one of the later albums, one of the last albums I came to in my collection. So it's...
We played this one quite a bit, didn't we?
We did, and it's a good one to do live. You can understand, it's a good... want to do live, which of course the Beatles never did, because they didn't play it live and they didn't do it on a BBC radio session, and they only did one mimed performance on a TV show exactly like It Won't Be Long.
They just had so much material they could do that, didn't they, sometimes?
Production, but you know,
well, yeah, but it's context. So I'm going to give it 64 for production.
Right.
Lyrics then. I don't think it is, but is this another Ringoism? He's got form with kind of time.
Well, it's been, it's been credited. At one point, Paul said it was a Ringo thing.
So,
But then he, other times he basically said, oh, it's a chauffeur he had once. And he was asking him, how's he been busy? And he was like, oh, I've been working 8 days a week.
Oh, okay.
And so apparently it came from that. And that's been repeated more actually than the Ringo thing. And Ringo's denied it was him.
Yeah.
So someone, I think it's someone said it to McCartney, and then he writes it together with John. But John seemed to be, I don't know whether John's confusing it or conflating it, or there was something else with Eight Arms to Hold You as the notion of the title of what becomes Help.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like he's getting mixed up, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it might have been that their plans were for this film to be called Eight Arms to Hold You, and he sort of had 8 days a week. Maybe that'll link in there a little bit. And again, they're trying to write a title track / single.
Maybe. I wonder how much, because 8 days a week, it's a great thing for him to pick up on, because it's a fun little phrase either way. And I wonder how common parlance it was, or if it's something that was just a very local or quirk of the person who said it, whoever it was.
Yeah. Well, I think if anything's made it more universal, it'll be this song existing rather than one chauffeur being a bit witty.
Yeah. But you don't hear it now because of the song, I think. So I wonder if he did it then, and anyone from the time would have gone, well, it's 8 days a week, isn't it? They've just taken that saying and made it into a song. But apart from the 8 days a week, a bit like It Won't Be Long, the rest of it's just a string of love me, hold me, I need your love, it's true, yes I do,
I think the point is they've moved on in their heads beyond what they were being expected to produce, or what they were producing, to meet deadlines and requirements and fill up albums and things.
Okay.
John called it manufactured.
Oh, okay.
He called it lousy.
Oh, dear.
You know, it's... Yeah.
Okay, well, you know... Importantly, it has a hook, something a little different, the 8 days a week bit to hold on to. So I'm going to give it a little bonus for that lyrically, but not much. So 48 for lyrics, which gives it 58.3 overall. And that is it.
Oh, Tiny Ruttles moment.
Oh, go on.
Again, we've already talked about Hold My Hand as the track equivalent of All My Loving mainly, but it does feature chords based on the opening chords of 8 days a week.
Ah, okay, there we go.
So that's 4 out of the 5 things we've done today have had some Ruttles relationship.
Well, bumper Ruttles. So, yes, we have one that's ended up in the top 10, and the others have landed as follows. Flying is 188th. It Won't Be Long is joint 109th with Sun King and I Need You. 8 days a week is 107th. And Martha, My Dear, is joint 76th with Mean Mr. Mustard and Taxman. And as I say, we will be sorting out these joint malarkeys at some point. So I'll do the top 10 and then a quick note about next week's episode and then we'll say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
At number 10, Eleanor Rigby. At number 9, Hey Jude. At number 8, Within You Without You. Across the Universe at number 7. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds at number 6. Penny Lane is number 5. At number 4, In My Life. At number 3, I'm the Walrus. Strawberry Fields Forever at number 2. And A Day in the Life at number 1. So just a quick note, because we've got an odd number of songs to finish on. We have 2 episodes left. We expect to have 4 songs in each, so we don't get a big episode and then a little episode. So
we're nearly done, aren't we?
We are nearly done. So don't be disappointed when next week we do 4, because I told you.
Yeah. So that's 2 weeks of 4 songs apiece.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll be having a little break, won't we?
We'll be having a little break. So I want to do a bit of a wrap-up, and we'll figure that out, whether we do that after the break. Or before the break, because
on the break whilst we're on holiday.
Well, yeah, we might, yeah, because with that, we'll literally be having a break at the same time in the same place. Yeah. So we'll see. So thank you very much. Same Beatle time,
same Beatle place.
We'll see you next time. Bye bye.
Good ruttles.